Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Ryan Radzeski, here with Greg Baer, and we're the co-authors of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids.
This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging and relevant learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
On today's episode, we're talking with David Yeager, a psychology professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the co-founder of the Texas Behavioral Science and Policy Institute. David is an expert in adolescent behavior and is celebrated all over the world for his research on motivation, engagement, and more. We're so excited to talk to him today. David Yeager, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me.
David, you started your professional life as a middle school teacher, and both of us could imagine you still in that classroom today, motivating your students in some extraordinary ways. But you're now well known around the world as a scientist who's working to deepen our understanding of adolescent behavior and well-being. So can you just tell us a little bit about that journey? What took you into the classroom, and then what took you away from the classroom into the learning sciences?
Yeah, I came to teaching mainly from a service perspective. I think my main activity as a high schooler and in college was service, especially in youth organizations. I lived and worked in an orphanage in Chile for a while, ran youth programming there. And when I graduated, I wanted to go be of service to the community. And you hear a lot about teachers where they're doing everything that they can while they're in the classroom. I had 8 preps a day. I was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade English, and I was K through 8 PE. And then during lunch, I was the English as a second language teacher for mostly immigrant kids from Guadalajara. And then after school, I coached 6th grade basketball, 8th grade basketball, the book club, the computer club. And then I would like fix the internet when it broke. And it was great. I loved it. But I ultimately felt like I wanted better advice on how to interact with my students. And as enthusiastic as I was, I still felt helpless a lot. And I felt like there was some exciting research, but I wanted to get at the big questions of like, what's really driving young people? What like can captivate them? Like, where does the drive for purpose or contribution and where does that come from and how do I cultivate it? So ultimately I left the classroom to go do science, not necessarily because I just wanted to be a scientist, but more like I felt compelled to generate the kinds of answers I would have wanted to have when I was a teacher.
And I think, you know, when most of us think of education and about learning in school, we think about what kids learn or how they're taught. And so much of your career has been defined by stepping back and first asking that question of what motivates students, what drives them. Can you talk a little bit about what motivation is and why it matters so much in learning?
I just had this experience that if you could get everyone on board with what you're doing, they would run through a brick wall for you. And that was my experience when I was a summer camp counselor, when I was a camper, and it was my experience in the classroom. You see this all the time where kids will do an assignment and they do the first draft and you've got a qualified teacher giving solid feedback just in time. It's like timely, it's concrete. And the kids look at the paper and they're like, I'm not responding to any of this. I'm mad at you that you wrote all these comments, and they're offended. Like a psychological barrier breaks down the learning process. And my argument is like, what if we could fix that? My favorite assignment was when I taught The Outsiders. I taught in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was a couple blocks away from where S.E. Hinton like literally visualized the drive-in. And like we went on a walking tour of the actual drive-in that S.E. Hinton had in mind when she wrote the book, and talked about youth violence and cycles of violence and aggression and what role they could play in changing it. And then they went back and then they made presentations on conflict resolution for the younger grades in our school. So the 7th graders were like teaching the 3rd and 4th graders how to deal with conflict. And all of a sudden they wanted feedback on their presentations. They wanted me to help them make it good. They were like, this isn't good enough. It's not going to solve the problem. If like they believed that the culture of their school depended on the quality of their presentation, then they were kind of down for the critical feedback. And that's an example of why I think motivation matters a lot.
So David, let's get into that science of motivation and talk about your best-selling book entitled 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People, A Groundbreaking Approach to Leading the Next Generation and Making Your Own Life Easier. Before we get into the science of motivation, I just have to ask you about that title, because as the dad of 2 teenagers, whom I love, You have a number there that says 25. You have this very expanded sense of the adolescent years. Can you just comment about that? Why the broadened sense of those years from 10 to 25?
The way adolescence researchers think about adolescence is it's the period of life in between the start of puberty, which is around 10. It might be a little earlier for some kids, a little later for others. And then it goes up until basically we take on an adult-like role in our culture. And that often, given the current state of the global economy, is 25, 27, 28. So you've got this big period where there's a shared set of motivations that are driving young people. And these are motivations around acquiring and demonstrating status and respect, and basically cultivating your reputation as someone who's viewed as meaningful and capable of doing something important. And that was really important in our evolutionary history and our survival, and it continues to be important today in different ways. Once you understand that we have that in common, then it's like, oh, okay, great. I can learn from stuff that great leaders do with 10-year-olds and apply it to older people. Or I could learn from great managers of 23-year-old employees and then apply it down with younger ages as well.
David, your book centers on understanding and responding to some of the core developmental needs of adolescents. And you just mentioned a few of them: status, respect, the ability to do important things. Can you talk a little bit more about what those core needs are for an adolescent and how we adults, whether we're teachers or parents, can help to nurture or help meet those needs?
I think my argument, and it's based on research from a lot of people like Ron Dahl and Adriana Galvan and other wonderful scholars that are in my field. The argument is that when you're a child, people generally take care of you and they don't evaluate you in terms of what you bring to the table, right? So like imagine humans wandering the savannah hundreds of thousands of years ago before we had houses or even caves really to live in. You don't look at a three-year-old and say, you didn't kill a woolly mammoth today. Get out of here. Like, I'm abandoning you. Parents take care of children. But at some point, if you're 16 and you're sitting there like a lump on a log and you haven't done anything, people are going to stop bringing you protein and watching out for you as you sleep and protecting you from warring tribes. And they're certainly not going to let you mate with someone else's daughter if like you're bringing nothing to the table. So like your ability to do anything that's adult-like in your culture and even to stay alive depends on the shared view that other people in your tribe have about your reputation for contribution. You know, society's different now. We have safety nets to some extent, but our brains actually haven't changed much in the last 200,000 years because evolution takes a while. And so those fears of social death, meaning physical death, they are still driving young people today. And what that means is that if we threaten young people in their social reputations, comes across as a threat to their reputation and therefore super demotivating.
You know, it was Fred Rogers who said, people don't change much when all they have is a finger pointed in their face. I think they only change in relation to someone who loves them. Is that what you're saying?
I think that if the person pointing the finger at you is someone whose opinion you really respect and care about and you view them as, you know, having your best interest at heart. I mean, there's all kinds of stories of really tough and demanding 1980s football coaches who got people to change. But it depends on a shared understanding. And if the understanding is that this is in the context of helping that person become excellent at whatever it is that they care about, then people are willing to suffer through things that are tough and demanding. But if it's about diminishing you and making you feel like a nothing and trying to humiliate you, then yeah, people aren't going to change. There's this classic dilemma where in adults' minds, we understand what the young person should be doing. We're like, you're making a poor choice. It's harming your future. Like, it's obvious to me and you won't listen to me. We think if only I could explain it clearly, then they would adopt my logic and make the exact same choice that I want them to make. But that comes across as super threatening to their autonomy, to their sense of self-respect, to their ability to make decisions. Even if we're right, and even if our explanations are sound, they're not processing it in the way we want. And as a result, they're not going to change.
This is Greg Baer, here with Ryan Rudzeski. And we're talking with the psychology professor and researcher David Yeager, author of 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People. So David, mindful of these core needs of adolescents, and knowing that you were once a teacher, how do you find teachers responding to your book and the things that you hope that they might learn or do? And are there things that you're doing to work with educators across this country and beyond?
I love teachers. I love working with them. They're the group I think about first often. Teachers are constantly under threat. I mean, like, everyone's blaming teachers all the time for everything. And so if someone shows up and says, actually, all of your instincts are wrong, you're doing everything wrong, that doesn't go over well. And so what I've learned is that if I want people to adopt the kind of stuff I'm talking about, the best approach is to tap into those deeper, more profound reasons for being a teacher and framing my recommendations as consistent with what people always wanted to do in the classroom. And so what we had to figure out was, all right, well, how do you then reframe this respect forward communication style that's going to tap into adolescent motivation as a version of what teachers always wanted to do, while also challenging them to do it better? And what I realized is that teachers are very frustrated when, in their minds, they've done a great lesson, they've explained the concept, they did a review, and then they get to the test, and then students, they've like forgotten everything that the teacher has taught them. And then like, well, am I really going to reteach this and now slow down the half that did pay attention, or am I just going to fail the half that didn't pay attention? And this happens again and again in a lot of teachers' classrooms. And our argument is, a big reason why this frustrating thing happens is because we haven't engaged students mastering the art of making them feel respected. And there are subtle, small things you can do to help them view difficulty and challenge not as a threat to their reputations, but instead as a chance to learn. And so we use a stern voice to try to show how serious we are, but students interpret that as they will suffer a reputational loss if they reveal any weakness or frustration or confusion or mistakes. And so what we argue is, like, actually, you can frame things differently, like with a sense of curiosity, you can offer to collaborate, you can praise a student for having the courage to reveal their mistaken thinking, to say, it's amazing you did this, now we're all getting smarter because you were willing to speak up about what didn't make sense to you. And if you reframe that confusion or mistake as a part of something that's high status, right, like being a great contributor to the classroom culture, then the students are more on board with it. And if you do that, then students comply, they're more willing, they're more engaged, and then teachers' lives are better.
You know, an experience that Greg and I have had again and again, and that I think we continue to have after, you know, writing and publishing our book, was that you spend so much time immersed in research and immersed in the science of what works that it inevitably changes you personally and the way you approach life and the way you care for young people. And I'm curious whether you had a similar experience with 10 to 25. Has it changed the way you interact with your own kids, the ways you interact with colleagues or just move through the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've absolutely used this stuff in my parenting, but I would never claim that I have fully nailed it. But it is something I think about all the time. When I was writing the book, I interviewed all these experts. Like, I found a great teacher. I found Microsoft's best manager. I found the NBA's best shooting coach. But one person I really talked to a lot was this parenting coach. And I pumped her for information. I was like, I need some help here. And I would say that there's a bunch of points that I write about in the book, but a couple of things that stand out to me is what you're aiming for is this combination of very rigorous, disciplined standards, but also lots of support so that they can meet the standard. So that means sometimes you have to maintain the standard and the kid doesn't like it and then they cry and rebel. And our instinct is to then pull back because we think if I'm causing distress in my child, then I'm doing something wrong. And that makes sense because when you have an infant, if your baby's crying and you don't do anything to help the baby, then you look like a bad parent. And you probably are a bad parent, you know, if you just let baby cry for infinity hours. But at some point, they're not crying because they're like hungry or need to sleep. You know, they're crying because you're telling them the way the world is and they don't like it, you know, and like that's not a bad lesson to learn. But then the issue is, OK, then how do you support them to actually meet that standard of the world? And then the way to do that, I've learned, is through questioning. Great mentors, you know, 90% of what they say is a question. They don't tell. And the questions are not accusatory. It's not like a law school professor trying to humiliate you in class. It's more like you're legitimately curious why, from their perspective, some decision made sense to them so that you can walk them through an alternative logic in a way that makes sense to them. But the critical thing is that the kid has to do the thinking. And one example I like to use, which isn't about teenagers, but my son Ronan, who's 6 now, and he was like 4, he would come downstairs in the mornings, like at 6, and he would stack a chair on top of another chair, and he would climb up those two chairs and then reach on his tippy toes for like candy or a cookie. And I would come downstairs at 6 in the morning. And my instinct is to yell and be like, Ronan, what are you doing? And like, get down from the chair right now. This is unsafe. You're in trouble or whatever. But then I learned to just say, Ronan, what is your plan? And then he would look around and be like, oh my God, I have no plan. This is a very precarious situation. And then he started having to think for himself about what his plan was. And he doesn't do that anymore. Also, he's older. But like that kind of philosophy, asking questions so that they do the thinking is critical. And I'd say I use that the most now in coaching. So I coach travel baseball, but I also coach the fourth grade basketball team. And if you're a baseball coach, like in a lot of sports, it's very tempting to sit there and position the kid's body like they're a G.I. Joe. And you can't do that because they got to hit a moving ball and they got to make decisions. The static mechanics is actually not the task of the sport. And so it needs to be more like they take a swing and be like, how did that feel? And then they're like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, okay, let's take another one. And I want you to pay attention to how it felt. Okay, where did the ball go? How did it feel? How was that swing? And you have to have them explain their logic and thinking. And if you do that, then now outside of the 1 hour you're practicing with them, if they're practicing another 10 hours a week, they're coaching themselves in their own heads. And that's ultimately what you want. And the biggest pushback I get from parents on that is they're like, well, I don't have time. It's not the time to have a Socratic dialogue about your feelings. I'm like, yeah, and 80 to 90% of the time you will ever spend with your child in your life is over by the time they're 18.
Oh.
How have you used that time? Like, did you use the time to just temporarily solve some problem to make yourself feel better versus did you actually teach them a skill to solve a problem?
All right, David, even though I feel like you just threw a brick at me, because now I'm like mourning the time that I've wasted with my kids and recalculating how I'm going to spend the fleeting years that I have, I'm going to be a good guy and throw you a softball. It's so fun to see the ways that you and others have taken your work. Can you tell us a little bit about the fellowship that you have working with educators and also the app that folks in the workforce are now using?
This book project came out of a desire to go figure out what adults could do to create more growth-oriented pro-learning environments. Not just like, what are adults doing wrong and what do we need to change, but like, what is the program that is scalable that could potentially reach millions of people around the world? So in parallel to writing the book, we were creating that program. And by we, it's Carol Dweck, my colleagues Chris Bryan, Cameron Hecht, Mary Murphy, who wrote a book called Cultures of Growth, Matt Gianni, a lot of wonderful folks that I love and work with. So everything in the book is not just like some abstract nerd's hypotheses. I mean, some of it's abstract and it's all nerdy and some are hypotheses, but we were doing it at the same time as I was writing the book. So we did all this research and then I was like, all right, now we feel good about the results. We feel good about the philosophy here. What is the program that could scale? And that is where we came up with something we call FUSE, Fellowship Using the Science of Engagement. Just like the kids need status and respect, we learned that for teachers to change, they also need to be taken seriously and respected. And so rather than give teachers just a bunch of inert scientific knowledge and tell them you're supposed to do the stuff differently, we instead framed it as a fellowship. So it's high status. It's like, you're learning science ahead of schedule. You are going to implement it in your own class in ways that only you could come up with. And then you're going to talk to your colleagues about what you're trying. They're going to give you advice. And then at the end of the year, you'll present in a showcase to other people in the network on what you tried this year. So the kinds of practices they try are like, write a first day of class speech. What does a mistake mean? What are you going to say when a student asks a question or it comes in after class? These are things that teachers eventually get to in the year, but we're like, say it on day one and be intentional about it. And the results of FUSE have been very good. So we've had about 200 teachers and about 20,000 students go through it. It's a broad, diverse sample, actually a random sample across the state of Texas. And we find students learn more. They learn, it's about 2 to 3 times the effect size of Khan Academy or of all these curricula. That's on performance. But on top of that, we see a 50% reduction in burnout among teachers and also an improvement in satisfaction with life overall. Like teachers, after being in the fellowship, are more likely to say, if I could live my life over, I wouldn't change anything, right? And that's pretty remarkable because, you know, your professional identity is very wrapped up in your overall life satisfaction when you're in a serving profession, right? Like teaching. Helping teachers engage students and have these like enthusiastic classrooms full of learning, really motivating for teachers and it helps kids, but then teachers, they can basically deal with the stresses of their jobs a little bit better.
That's phenomenal. I hope we hear more about that soon, and not just in Texas, all across this country. David, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. We're going to close with a little bit of a lightning round. I'm just going to ask you a couple of rapid-fire questions, and you just respond with the first word or phrase that comes to mind. Sound good?
Sure.
All right. Most surprising thing you've learned about learning?
I'd say the importance of motivation above and beyond how clearly the content is explained or how high quality the curriculum. It's motivation in relationship with the person who's asking you to learn something. Like, why do you care that they're asking you to do it?
The research study or experiment you most wish you'd done yourself?
I love the Mueller and Dweck 1998 paper and the great job, you're smart versus great job, you tried hard. It's a beautiful study. I use that as my paradigm of like a clean, perfect study.
Things that motivate you, David Yeager, today?
I'm trying to get good at coaching baseball, not at the elite level, but how do you help a whole community have kids who can get better even if their parents haven't been paying for private lessons? So like, let's call it like inclusive excellence in youth baseball is what I'm most excited about figuring out right now.
You filmed a masterclass, which is one of the most popular courses on that entire platform. Coolest moment from producing that?
Probably getting Steve Young, the NFL quarterback, to be a special guest and hearing how excited he was about mindset and getting to meet him was really, that was a real treat.
When the 90% is up, when your 90% of time is up with your kids, what do you hope will be true?
I hope that they can make principled decisions about how they're going to spend their time and the kind of person they want to be. And I hope they have their options open. I'm not trying to make them into a specific thing. I want them to have enough options in front of them that they can make their own choices and have the chance to shift if they want to.
And David, before we go, just one more question. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
I mean, people always ask me what, if I could wave a magic wand, what I would change about education. And I always say I would make it more like summer camp, that every summer we have these amazing young people who motivate the heck out of our teenagers. And then we just dissolve that entire workforce. The same people who taught our kids how to like do the ropes course or water ski for the first time or participate in the team competitions, we don't get them around our kids anymore, except for a week or two in the summer. So I think, like, let's surround our kids with people who have that, like, joie de vivre, and let's keep them in the workforce of working with kids.
Thanks again to David Yeager, author of 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.